Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak to you this morning. Why am I here? I was in Washington, D.C. last week attending an oceans conference hosted by Secretary of State John Kerry. The purpose of the conference, as its title implies, is what's happening to our oceans and how do we deal with that reality. It struck me, one thing struck me, let me mention very quickly. It was really cool to be in a gathering at which among the speakers of the morning were, I don't know whether any of you have heard of Nainoa Thompson, but a Polynesian voyaging canoe is making its way around the world. He was one of the speakers. Secretary Kerry himself spoke. A guy named Barack Obama spoke. And then Leonardo DiCaprio spoke. And I have a habit of texting or sending messages to my grandchildren as I travel and see cool things. And so I mentioned what I had just seen. And one of my granddaughters texted back and said, "Send picture of Leonardo." So kids have their priorities straight. But I just want to comment quickly on what I saw or came away from from that conference. And I think it's important to us here in Southeast. NGOs matter. Environmental organizations matter. Particularly as the world deals with climate change, in that room were some of the most powerful people in the world, and none of them were members of government. They did not represent governmental agencies. They represented billions of dollars that are available to deal with the reality of our world today. In Alaska, our conversation in recent years has been more about Arctic policy than it has been about climate change. We know the reality. And we need ultimately, well, right now, to deal with that reality. The governor will soon be establishing a climate change process for and structure for the state of Alaska to be more, in a more focused way, engaged. When one travels outside Alaska, particularly to Washington, D.C., Alaska is a very small place. When we visit D.C. and talk about the things that we typically talk about, it struck me at that conference that Alaska, on every globe, on every slide, every presentation that was made at that conference was there. And it looms large physically. It looms large in the context of the worldview of climate change. We know that there is research analysis taking place. Focus more on the interface of climate change and Arctic policy in Alaska, but relative to what is happening in the world, it is modest. We know two things. Alaska is America's only Arctic place. We are working as hard as we can to take advantage of that obviously in terms of our own interest as a state, but in order to capture the view of the world and resources to deal with that reality that we do not have. Climate change is a bit more fuzzy in Alaska. But let me give you a story I think folks in Petersburg might relate to. My oldest son is a commercial fisher. He began fishing with me when he was about 10, Mark. Was fishing on his own at age 18. He fishes the Gulf of Alaska as a power troller, a longliner, and occasionally as a gill netter. He said to me last winter, he's almost 50 now, he said to me last winter, he said, "I'm beginning to lose my internal compass as I fish. Things are changing. Water temperature's changing. Weather patterns are changing. The timing of fish runs are changing. It's obvious, but I can't see it, that what I have come to know is no longer serving me in ways that it should." I think we all feel that as we're out in the natural world. At that conference, as I said, were billions of dollars, and they were pledging more. That was one of the purposes of that conference, to get NGOs around the world to focus and put their dollars into dealing with this entire issue of climate change. And climate change, I don't think it's particularly arguable, but Alaska is ground zero for the North Pacific. What happens in the Gulf of Alaska, right on my doorstep in Yakutat, affects the rest of the world. It affects us every single day. I don't want to belabor it, but those of you in the room who are leaders of your communities, of organizations that are so important to Alaska, think about the role of NGOs, think about issues that affect our communities that result from a changing climate. No matter how tenuous the connection may be right now, it is growing and it is growing fast. And we need to be thinking about working as hard as we can to access the resources that are available out there. And I think Alaska can make a very compelling place. I'd be glad to have conversations with those who have an interest for the remaining time that I'm here. And at any time, of course, by contacting me in Juneau. I just want to mention also briefly that the state of Alaska has issued two disaster declarations for the failure of the Pink Salmon Run in Kodiak and in Prince William Sound. We have requests from other regions and communities coming in. The state has requested federal disaster declarations for at least those two regions. As I said, Prince William Sound and the Kodiak area. We know that there have been run failures in several other parts of the state, and we are working all of that as aggressively as we can. Mayor Mark Jensen, thank you so much for the letter that you had published on your concerns about transboundary mines, the impact on those rivers that flow into southeast Alaska, the concerns that we all have about particularly mining development in British Columbia. And I just want to give you a quick update on what the state of Alaska is doing. Some of you saw possibly all of you, a letter from our delegation to Secretary of State John Kerry regarding a desire and specific request to have the federal government more fully engaged in this issue, asking the federal government to coordinate, reach out to the Canadian national government in order to focus attention and hopefully to determine ways that those two national governments can be in leadership roles in looking at the future of these transboundary river corridors in ways that a state and a province are not able to. Quickly, on the provincial state level, we've been working with the British Columbia government Governor Walker and I have been in office to create a structured capacity that would outlast this administration to work with the government of British Columbia specifically to allow the state of Alaska to protect its interests in the permitting of mines in British Columbia by the British Columbia government. The Canadian governmental system is very different from ours. Provinces have very significant prerogatives that state governments in Alaska do not have. Their relationship with their federal government is in many ways very different. For example, in Canada, the national government is responsible for fisheries almost exclusively. Of course, here it's at least within state and nearshore waters and within state waters and on all of our other rivers and habitat, the state of Alaska has primacy. Although that's being challenged right now. Some of you may know also that just recently the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has declared that and is promulgating regulations, I don't know whether they've been published yet, that they will, that is the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, will assume responsibility for fish and game management on all of their lands. Of course, the state is going to have to be responsive to what is essentially a challenge to the state's sovereignty. States manage fish and game resources on public lands in their states. That's an aside. The statement of cooperation, which is the resulting framework, and that's all it is. It's a framework for the state of Alaska to be able to work as cooperatively, as forward-leaning as is possible with the BC government as they permit mines, and over time, as they might take other actions that would potentially or in real terms affect the habitat, the environmental systems that make up these transboundary river corridors, to allow us to work together in ways that Alaska, I was listening to Marilyn, so I'm thinking airplanes, would allow Alaska to have its hand on the throttles, even if those throttles are manipulated by BC, in order to know what they're doing, in order to assert our sovereignty, if and when that might ever become necessary, and to constantly know what they are doing. We also see that framework as an opportunity to communicate broadly with those that are affected by the decisions that British Columbia makes, both on our side of the border and on their side of the border. First Nations in Canada are hugely important. The National Government of Canada has three of its principal cabinet officers, ministers, comparable to our federal secretaries, who are First Nations persons. Prime Minister Trudeau has made relationships and working with First Nations a key cornerstone of his government. In order to help us have a working relationship both with British Columbia and with the Canadian national government, I traveled to BC, Vancouver, 2 weeks ago, asked a vice president of the Tlingit Haida Central Council to accompany me, introduced that individual to both ministers of the BC government, and had separate meetings with First Nations leadership in order to strengthen the working relationship between tribes on our side of the border and First Nations on the BC side. The letter that our delegation sent to Secretary Kerry just recently was one that I had planned to sign on to, I was traveling, the logistics of getting the final draft approved by the state in the time frame that our delegation desired to send the letter meant that I wasn't able to sign it, but I support fully all that was requested in that letter. The SOC, the Statement of Cooperation, is just one part of a much more broad-based effort dealing with our federal government, dealing with the federal government of Canada, and of course, the province, and again, stakeholders. If there is anything I hope people take away, you know, Governor Walker and I have been asked by folks, what is going to be your legacy? What are the one or two or three big things you guys are going to do to change the world? Because that's kind of what you have to do. That's what administrations do. And we talked about it and thought about it. And we said, it may not be big, but our legacy is that Alaskans know we engage with them every single day on issues that are important to them, period. We might prioritize among those, but our administration is focused on the notion that if there is legacy in that, that's fine. If not, so what? And in order to engage, you must communicate. And effective communication is anybody here who's been to a conference of any kind over the last 20 years, you know, it's a circle, people look at every, you know, to communication is a process of engagement, of listening, of learning, of hopefully doing some teaching if that is appropriate to your experience and your knowledge. But ultimately, having a relationship, and this is the way I define it, that when you make a decision, those that are most impacted have been part of that decision making. A good case in point, and it comes from here in Petersburg, the governor looking at the place of the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission looked at it inappropriately, strictly as a budget issue. We can save $1 million by kind of merging a lot of what the CFEC does into the Department of Fish and Game. And we did not engage with the folks most affected. And we were sued. And we said, whoa, what's this all about? And so after internal discussion, the governor put in abeyance the implementation of the administrative order that he had signed and put out and directed implementation of and pulled it back and said, we're going to meet with the folks that are affected by this decision, and we're going to figure out a way to deal with this issue where it's a win-win for everyone. We had internal advice. Governors don't do that. You don't withdraw an administrative order. That shows weakness. And the governor said, I violated my own principle, and that is reaching out and having conversation and understanding those affected in the decisions that I was making. We would like for us, even if those decisions are not agreed with, that people respect the process, that their voice was heard, that they had engagement. It's one of the reasons that I ran for governor and why I'm lieutenant governor and loving it. I saw Alaska's government disengaging from Alaskans in many, many small ways that were leading up to very large ways. And one of the things that I know from my life's experience is that when government is not listening, when government is not engaging, leaning into the wind of the voice of the public, small people suffer. People with power will find a way to have access and to be heard. But so many who live their lives every single day believing in the goodness in government and in the impact of governmental policy overall on their lives, when they begin to question that, my friends, democracy is in trouble. That's why I ran. That's important to what we're trying to do with our relationship with British Columbia, to engage stakeholders, to communicate, to hear. In the development of the SOC, we're on our third iteration, getting feedback from stakeholders, meeting with them again on Friday in Juneau before we finalize that document. We are completely with the people of Southeast Alaska on this quest to make sure that those transboundary rivers remain as pristine, as environmentally intact and productive as they have been and are now far into Alaska's future. That was kind of an applause line. I say that because you're really kind of a stiff crowd, you know. You can tell when you get in a conference. Sometimes, boy, people will clap at the drop of a donut. But I want to, of course, spend a few minutes talking about the Alaska Marine Highway System. What Governor Walker and I have established, largely resulting from your leadership, is all about what I just mentioned of engaging with the folks who are served, engaging with those who have the most to gain or lose by the decisions we take. That's the reason for the process that is underway. I'd like to make just a couple of comments. I've made some of these before, I think, but I think they're worth emphasizing. There needs to be a purpose, there needs to be a goal, needs to be clear, needs to be achievable. And in most instances, when there's a lot at stake, the work is hard. I served 33 years on the board of Alaska Air Group and Alaska Airlines, longer than any other director than Bruce Kennedy and Ron Cosgrave. Mostly because I think they put me on the board and then forgot about me. And I know from that experience what good, strong leadership can achieve. Alaska Airlines after the 9/11 disaster, crisis, world-changing event, was one of just two airlines that said, we will not declare bankruptcy in order to blow out our pensions, in order to do away with our labor contracts, in order to create the opportunity to be a different airline using this fundamental change in our world. The airline had, at the board level and elsewhere, we've been wrestling with this notion of knowing that the airline industry in its entire existence, the entire industry in America, I don't know about internationally, but in America, since its inception up until 2001, when we did this calculation, the airline industry as a whole had never recovered its cost of investment of invested capital. What kind of business model is that? It had been supported by governmental regulation and subsidy in very significant ways and at critical times. And we made the simple declaration that by the year 2010, Alaska Airlines would have a 10% return on its invested capital. We called it the 10-10 plan, 10% by 2010. Pretty straightforward. But it entailed a look and action at every level of the company in order to achieve. Fundamental amongst that effort, involvement, was the relationship with employees. The airline industry is heavily unionized by law or by the operation of law. And we knew that if we did not reshape the company's relationship with its work groups, that we could not succeed. It took a decade to get to where we wanted to get, but we did. And Marilyn gave you a summary of where that company is today. One of the greatest companies in the world. If you go anywhere and talk to folks about the best companies in the world, not just America, Alaska Airlines is on the list. I relate that to you because it's no different from what we need to achieve with the Alaska Marine Highway System. It's profound, but it's simple in its definition. And we have the opportunity, with your leadership, with folks engaged from across the entire system, to make the Alaska Marine Highway System an enduring, iconic, productive, and even celebrated element of both Alaska as a society and a recognized and fully accepted element of a statewide integrated transportation system. And of course, in order to get there, it has ultimately to be recognized as a key element of our overall economy and having consequential economic impact. One of the challenges, and you know it, you deal with it constantly, is that among the communities served are the smallest and most fragile in Alaska. And to be very blunt, some communities that are very different from from other communities in our state. I submit to you that if the work you do does not meet those communities' needs, you'll have failed. Simple as that. Every community that can, within the ability of our collective resources, be connected via transportation infrastructure to the rest of our state must necessarily be. There are some places that we know we have to do it differently. Some places that it may not just be possible to meet it with a particular modality, but the public policy imperative and the application of necessary resources to connect Alaskans, no matter where they live, with one another is one of the things that will define Alaska's future. We talk about no child being left behind. We embrace that notion, even though as a public policy slogan, it's kind of in the trash heap now. But we must feel that way about everyone, every single one of our communities. I'll just leave you with this final comment, and it's easy for me to say. I'm gallivanting around, skipping over the wave tops. But now, as we discussed before, is one of a few moments in Alaska's history where the application of our experience, of our knowledge, of our character, of our morality can allow us to create a system that is both economical and meets our needs for the future, and have an audience across Alaska ready to accept it and embrace it if we do it right. I want to close by talking a little bit about Alaska's fiscal circumstance. Governor Walker has made it a point since his vetoes of the 2017 budget, totaling over $1 billion, were made. Traveling to many communities, I believe Petersburg included, and apologizing for the vetoes that he felt compelled to make, knowing that the impact on municipalities, on community services, on the full range of serving the people in those places, that they were going to feel it most, and that those entities of leadership would be required to step up because the state had not acted. I may get pilloried for this, but I'm going to say it. I've been around in public life for over 50 years. If we have public policy determined by somehow achieving what you choose to achieve, and in order to get there, someone else has to lose, we got a broken system. In many ways, that's where political parties have taken us today. In order for one to win, the other one has to lose. I don't think anyone can dispute that as a general statement. The evidence is just too strong. Having said that, I believe that the 2017 legislature will finally act to resolve Alaska's fiscal crisis. I believe that simply because it must. It must. In 2 years since we've known of this crisis, we have burned through over $7 billion of our reserves. Reserves that could have been used to reduce the cost to every Alaskan of the revenues that you must ultimately pay in order to meet Alaska's governmental services. Each year, as we draw down on our reserves, going forward, it means you have to pay more for the services that you expect. It's that simple. The arithmetic is absolutely clear. No one in the marketplace, in leadership, nationally, internationally, forecast at all that oil prices will recover anytime soon in any meaningful way. Those that do, those that do suggest that the long-term price average will be likely in the $80 to $90 range. And even that is built upon uncertainty. The revenues that have sustained Alaska for the 50 plus years now of its existence are gone. We will always have petroleum revenue in Alaska's budget. It will continue to be significant. $1 billion and more is nothing to sneeze at, but it will not be the sustaining driver of both governmental funding and our economy, not even close to what it has been in these first 50 years of Alaska's existence. I believe the 2017 legislature will do what it must because the alternatives are too draconian to consider. One thing we haven't talked a lot about is the lost opportunity to Alaskan society and Alaska's economy by these 2 years of inaction. We know that our economy must diversify. We know that the underpinnings of our economy have essentially fundamentally altered. We should have begun that conversation on day one. How do we grow Alaska again? We postponed that conversation for 2 full years, years we will never get back. The 2017 legislature will continue because it will take, I assume, the entire legislative session to achieve a fiscal plan. An entire session of the Alaska legislature that should be focused on growing Alaska again, and we will not have that conversation. And we cannot afford not to have that conversation. We have the strength of our seafood industry. We have the tourism industry. We have local government. We have the governmental sector that is hugely important to the economy of our state. We have a range of other much smaller, both opportunities and in development or existing segments of our economy. But the hole is too big in both our budget and our economy for us to let another session go by without resolving this issue. So thank you so much for this opportunity and look forward to speaking to you again.